the short term and the long term, this is actually the Buddhist view. In other words, what Buddha is saying, Buddhism is saying that Buddhism doesn't posit a creator in the same way that I suppose most other what we call religious views, you know, would say. This is the concept of God as the creator of reality, the creator of universes, the creator of beings. This is not a Buddhist view. And it's probably in the sense that as so-called religion, it's one of the major differences between Buddhism and all others. And it's for this reason, I think, that people would often say that Buddhism isn't a religion, because we tend to assume that something that is a religion, it assumes a creator God. It seems to be an assumption. This is not, again, not the Buddhist view. Buddhism would say definitely it is a religion in the sense of it being a spiritual path, in the sense of it being a path that deals with the, you know, with the inner part of a human being and of all living beings. And so the central point in Buddhism, if you like, Buddha's actual explanation of how come reality is the way it is, universes are the way they are, sentient beings are the way they are, you know, is all explained by this view of cause and effect, this concept of karma. And there are different ways of looking at it. I mean, there's the ways of describing how the universe came into being in relation to karma, and then there's the more experiential, day-to-day way of looking at the concept of karma. Because one of the key points also in Buddhism is that the various teachings and the philosophy and the rituals and the methods and the meditation techniques, whatever, all of them finally have to be something that we take and put into our lives and make experiential, make something real, you know. All of Buddhist philosophy is pointing to practice. This is the point, you know. So the experiential way of looking at karma is in terms of seeing that whatever we experience, if we label something, and if you think of it in a simple way, you know, whatever we experience, we can put it under two headings: suffering and happiness. If you think about it, levels of them. That's all. But basically, the suffering and the happiness. If you think about it, everything you experience from moment to moment, as many moments as there are in a day, you can put all your experiences under either one of these headings. Sometimes hard to see when things are almost like, you could say perhaps there's a third heading called indifferent. But let's forget about those. So the whole Buddha's explanation of why we suffer, why we're happy, the main cause of it is not, one of the key things is it's not the external. The main cause of my suffering is not the other person being unkind to me. The main cause of my suffering isn't the weather, the external world. The main cause, and this is where it becomes something experiential, is, according to Buddhism, is within our own mind. So in the very short term, we can see this in a simple way, you know, that if I have the propensity to be angry and then someone does a certain thing, we can see, you know, that it's fairly easy to see when you have two people, let's say at the bus stop, you know, one person's angry and one person's patient. Well, it's clear that same activity of the bus being late brings a very different effect, doesn't it, in the two different people. So we can, even from this point of view, it's fairly easy to see that the person's anger, the main cause of it isn't the bus being late. Because if it were, both people would be equally angry. It clearly is the anger in the person's mind. And the main reason the other person doesn't suffer so much is because they have more patience. So what Buddhist practice is all about is really looking at this very simple thing. Looking, in other words, learning to take more responsibility. This is the most short-term, simple way of understanding karma, you know. That if we can really begin to see that if we change our own mind, then we can learn to really increase our happiness and lessen our suffering, which is the bottom line for every one of us. If you check why we do what we do, you know, why we make choices, why we have this job, why we choose that relationship, why we make our simple choices from day to day, it's the most basic ways. It's in terms of what causes us happiness and what causes suffering. We want to have happiness, we don't want to have suffering. It's almost so simplistic that we don't think about it that way, but if you check your activities, if you check the actions of your dog and your cat, it's the same thing, you know. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, changing the outside world, choosing the food you prefer, having the better designed house, that's okay. The Buddha's view is that what happens is that we invest too much energy, we give too much power to the outside. In other words, you can say our philosophy now, in general, is that the outside world is the cause of happiness, and the outside world is the cause of suffering. We kind of know that anger makes us, we sort of know anger makes us miserable, but our real philosophy is that if we keep getting the right people in front of us, we won't get angry. We keep believing in that, don't we? We keep acting in this way. So although we do know that anger does play a part in it, that our own mind has some part in it, we actually, but the evidence proves, the way we act, proves we really believe the outside person's the cause. And this is the thing, for the most simple level of Buddhist practice in relation to karma is to learn to take more, is to look more inside and to take, and to give more power to our own mind and less power to the outside. And actually it's a very practical thing, because if we have the humility to see this, then we can prove that it works, you know. Any one of us, we know if we can control our anger, if we can learn to transform it, let go of it, change it, then we become more happy. There is simply no question. So the most basic level of karma, if we could just do this much, already our lives would be extraordinary. You know, it's very clear. So why is it so hard? Even at this level, forget about the more long-term views of karma in relation to past lives and future lives, which for many of us is an esoteric idea, which we can talk about. But at this most basic level, if we could get that together, you know, already incredible, already amazing. If we could do this, already the world would be an extraordinary place. Doesn't matter whether you even so-called believe in future past lives or whatever, any of this. If we can actually empower our own minds more and really begin to change our own mind, you know. And it's empowering because if you check the kind of mentality that comes with really believing the outside as the cause of our suffering and the cause of our happiness, this mentality is actually one of the victim. You check, you know. It's kind of saying that I am completely the victim of whatever happens. I have no control. The weather's bad, just have to be miserable. Someone smiles at me, just have to be happy. Delicious cake in front of me, have to be happy. Ugly cake in front, have to suffer. It's like we're really saying that we don't have a choice. And it really is that we're giving too much, you know, it really is that we're giving all the power to someone else, something else, to the outside world. And that, in a sense, is saying, I don't have any power. It's the victim mentality. So if we, you know, if we could see it this way, it's a very tasty way to understand why we should lessen, you know, change our anger, lessen our anger, lessen our pride, lessen our jealousy, increase our patience and generosity and love and all the rest. It's just a logical reason. It's a psychological, logical reason, you know. Not some, in other words, you know, when we, especially in our culture, when we talk about something as being spiritual, religious, you know, we always think of it as something that someone is saying I should do. Somehow, for some reason, I should be this way. Because God said or somebody said, you know. This is not the Buddhist approach. The Buddhist approach is demanding through, you know, whatever, through the meditation techniques, through our own, we learn to look more at our own mind. Recognize more what is happening in our own mind. Understand our own mind more. Meaning understand our motives. Understanding our views, understanding all the chatter that goes on all day, every day, you know. And it's obvious. I mean, this is something that's kind of, these ideas aren't so foreign to us, especially the last, you know, 20, 30, 50, 60 years, psychology and psychotherapy and these various techniques are very common in our culture. So this type of speaking is not so foreign to us. But this is the actual substance of Buddhist spiritual practice. I mean, Buddha's been talking this for 2,500 years, you know, not just the last 50. So in other words, practice, spiritual practice in Buddhist terms, is dealing with your own mind. Is being your own therapist, as one Lama said. Sounds like a nice cliche, but there's a very deep truth to it, you know. This is spiritual practice. Spiritual practice isn't just, I mean, indeed in Buddhism, especially in Tibetan Buddhism, you've got all the area of what we call, what we seem to think of as spiritual, the rituals and the prostrations and the altars and looking like this, dressed as a nun and all this stuff, you know, and vows and seemingly spirit, many prayers, all of this stuff. But the whole approach in Buddhism, that isn't separate. Those techniques aren't separate from the psychological part. Whereas in our culture now, isn't it? We've got philosophy, psychology, religion. They're all very separate and we don't see any relationship. That's not the Buddhist view, which is interesting, I think. So a person who's full-on Tibetan Buddhist, let's say, does their prayers, does their rituals, does their meditations and their practices and their, you know, but also does the work of being their own therapist, because that's the very heart of practice. You can do all the other stuff, but in a sense it's hollow unless you're doing the real job of looking into your own mind. And the real, and the essence of that, the very central point in Buddhist practice, is this understanding and therefore this application of this view of karma, cause and effect. That I'm responsible. That I can be responsible. That I can actually learn to shift and change my life and become more happy. This is the simple point, and less suffering. And therefore, kinder and more compassionate to other people. And therefore, change the world. Because if each one of us led our lives in this way, it's inevitable that the world would change. It's natural, it's obvious. Yeah. And we just look around us. We can see that we live in a culture where the philosophy is the outside is to blame. We can see, every day, look at this world. It's evident that that's the philosophy we're all living by. That's the philosophy we uphold. Well, this philosophy in Buddhist terms is called samsara. You know, we're all samsarists, in other words. A samsarist, I'm using the term loosely, this term samsara, it refers to the whole approach of being caught up in these deluded states of mind, of anger and jealousy and pride, and believing that the causes of them are the outside. Therefore, the job is to change the outside, then I'll be happy. You know, to change the outside, then I'll suffer less. Get rid of the external enemy, then I'll be happy. Buddhism says that's samsara. So we're all samsarists right now. And we can see it's our philosophy. We don't think of it as our philosophy. We just think of it as real, don't we? We think, well, this is how things are. I notice that I feel miserable when someone is mean to me, so it must be right. Isn't it? It's how it feels. We don't think that our mother taught us this philosophy when we were a child, like she taught us our Catholic philosophy or something, you know. So this, and it is so instinctive in this, we can see. Okay, Buddhism has an explanation of how come. And this is all the continuity of consciousness and past lives and blah, 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 you know. But this motor simple level, which is not a foreign idea to us, but we can see it is foreign in the sense of the difficulty of it. It's enormously hard to do such simple words, you know. Look into your own mind. Change your own mind. Such a simple thing to say. It's not even a complicated philosophy, you know. It's something so simple. But look how difficult it is, you know. Every day it's a struggle, isn't it? Every one of us can see. Even if we've been trying to do this for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, all our life, you know, we can see it is so hard. It's like going against what seems to be natural. It seems to be natural to point the fingers outside. It seems to be natural, doesn't it, to blame the other person. Look at the raging in our minds. We mightn't have to be some maniac going around shooting people to know that our mind can be so angry, you know, full of anger, endless thoughts. Blaming, pointing fingers, resentful, bitter, if only this, he this, she this, blah, 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 not stopping, isn't it? And we're still smiling and being normal person. No one can see a maniac inside, you know? You know what I mean? Every day it's a struggle. Okay, Buddhism says it's because we've got this habit for eons. This is the very nature of suffering. So whether we're, you know, African, American, Israeli, it doesn't matter what our external culture is, we all share this samsaric philosophy. This is Buddha's view. And that this is the cause of our suffering. This is the cause of our suffering. This exact viewpoint, instinctively held in our mind, is why we suffer. Whether it's people in a relationship, whether it's a country, whether it's two countries, you know, families, groups, doesn't matter. Two animals, two ants. Same reason. So of course, when you have this philosophy, then everything that happens, we use the logic of this philosophy to prove our point. So every time someone is mean to me, it increases my belief in the philosophy that the outside world causes me suffering, because it seems to prove it, doesn't it? Oh, well, I felt bad again. So that's the logic we use. It seems faultless logic, doesn't it? The difficulty is, you know, to learn to see how that's faulty. To start to understand every time I get angry with a person who says something mean to me. And to apply this, the philosophy, let's say the Buddhist philosophy, that the reason I'm suffering now, this moment, isn't because he said those words, but is because of the presence of the anger in my mind. This is not difficult to see. It is difficult to see because our habit, in its nature, it's not difficult to see. Because it's in its nature, it's not difficult to see, but it is difficult to see because it's not been our habit. That's why. We've obscured ourselves. For so long we've been caught up in the view, you know, that and the belief in our own interpretation. Every time he's mean to me, boom, I'm suffering because he said those mean words. And so the Buddhist one's saying, every time he's mean to me, you know, I'm suffering and I get angry, I'm suffering because of my anger. Just pointing the finger in a new place, that's all. But of course then, the irony is too, we think, oh, that's bad because that means I've got to feel guilty. That's not at all. It's the whole point to hear this one, so simple, one we all know, you know, is to see that it's a practical issue. It's a practical thing. The bottom line is, do you want to be happy? Do you want to feel less stressed, less miserable, less neurotic, more kind, more loving? Every one of us would have to say yes. You know. If a dog could answer, the dog would say yes. It's so clear to us. So all Buddha's saying, well, honey, the methods you're using now don't work. Give them up. Not for moralistic reasons, because he said so, which is how we think of religion. No. It's simply because it doesn't work. And if we have the humility to look, we will recognize the truth of this. And that's why, again, the emphasis in Buddhism isn't doing something because somebody said, which is how we tend to think of religion, you know. The reason to do something is because it works. And what we're dealing with here is learning how to discover, you know, how to uncover our extraordinary human potential. According to Buddhism, we all possess innately astonishing potential within our own being right now to be more happy, more wise, more loving, more kind, all the rest, all these words we know so well. They are our natural potential. It's waiting to be uncovered. Now, we want to be happy. Yes, I want to be more loving, more kind, more happy, please, we say. Definite, we know this. But all Buddha's saying is we're using the wrong methods. Not wrong, again, in a moral sense. Simply wrong because they don't work. It's a practical thing. It's so important to hear it in this way, which is not how we tend to hear so-called religion, is it? It's something truly psychological, you know. And all the practices in Buddhism, all the practices and the methods and techniques and the blah, 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 are all pointing to the doing of this job, are all meant to be methods to help us do this very job, you know. This is the point. And so, of course, it's all based on your own experience. I can say to you for sure, the reason I'm a Buddhist now, after so many years, is because so far, the little bit that I've tried to put into practice actually works. So if something works, you keep doing it. It's reasonable. If the method you use to make that delicious cake works, you'd be a fool to change it, wouldn't you? Same thing here. If things work, you know, and that's meant to be the point. To just blindly do something is ignorance, according to Buddhism. But to do it, you know, when you've got some conviction, because you know it works, then nothing can take it away from you. It doesn't matter what you call it then. Now, this is the most basic level of Buddhist practice, and in a sense, though, the most difficult too. It's easy to say, oh, I'm a Buddhist, and I accept karma and reincarnation, and go blah, blah, blah with all the theories. But just look into our own lives, you know, every day. It's so difficult. Because it's like spontaneous, isn't it? The response to see it on the outside, the moment that person says the mean words and the mind immediately starts interpreting it, the hurt is feeling here, and you see the person is unkind, you hear those mean words, you know. The whole story, isn't it? The whole story is kind of watertight. Her words are why I'm feeling miserable. It's a watertight story. We can't see it. We can't see that this is an interpretation that is faulty. It's hard to see this. I think this alone, I keep saying this, this is the most basic level I'm talking now. The view of karma extends to a much, you know, various other levels that go beyond past and future. About how even the universe came into being. All is to do with the concept of karma. We can discuss this. But this one, I tell you, this one is the most tasty because it's experiential. If in one day, every time we have an experience, and this is a skill to learn, I tell you. If you think of what you think of experiences, each day, isn't it? There's a whole there's you walking through your life, being here. Like the continuity is you from A to Z. You understand? Just think of it in those terms. There's you walking through each moment of each day, Okay? But each moment of each day, this you is having various experiences, isn't it? This person says this and smiles at you. That person is mean to you. The traffic is bad. The traffic is good. The food is good. The food is bad. The weather is nice. The weather is not nice. All these external things, right? Which we consider already life. This is life out there. Already we can see this is the main emphasis, you know. Already we're putting all our energy into this outside world. But if you can try and reverse that and think of you being the continuity, and if you think in this way, this is an example, then the various things happening to you are just catalysts, aren't they? They're various catalysts. If you see the world in this way, they're various catalysts for you to have a certain experience. And right now, the thing we mostly act on is the outside, as if that's the real cause. Whereas Buddhism's saying, like I said, it's a catalyst only. The real thing that's happening, from this perspective we're talking now, the real thing that's happening is what's in your mind. So if we have enough awareness, which is what we try to learn through meditation, to actually bring it, you know, instead of going out to him every time he says those mean words, or, oh, isn't he so divine, you know, all your energy goes out. Don't have the energy go out. Use that catalyst to bring the energy in and to check up what did just happen inside me. Label it accurately. Is it anger? Is it jealousy? Is it pride? Is it neurosis? Is it neediness? Is it attachment? Is it love? Is it kindness? Is it generosity? There's only so many names for each of the moments of our psychology, if you'd like. But we can do just this a few times a day. Already something profound, you know. This is practice. This is practice. This is practice. So, you know, when he says those mean words, instead of going, he this, which is what we do now, he this, endlessly, isn't it? The voice doing the story, he said this and he said that. We can't stop it, can we? So we're not talking about ourselves at all. We're not looking at ourselves at all. We're looking at him. We're describing him. We're analysing him. We're blaming him. We're assessing him. Nothing to do with my own mind. My own mind's working overtime. But the object of it is him. What we're trying to do here, in this first basic level of practice, is make, you know, the object of my mind, myself. Not in a self-centered way, in a practical way, to help recognize clearly, okay, Rabina, that's your anger. Shut up, you know. Or whatever method to use to help shift it, change it, alter the way we're feeling. And the way we're feeling is rooted in how we think. This is what's interesting, too. If we look at anger, you know, you check anger. Okay, like I said, all the thoughts are going on in your mind. You mightn't be sort of the heart pounding level of anger, which is at the beginning usually, you know, and then when it calms down for the rest of the day or half an hour or a month, whatever, depending on how strong your anger is, where is this anger existing? The person's action was last week, you know. But what's happening is this whole story, your head full of this story, isn't it? Endless. He this, you're going through all the things he did and he said, and this, you have a picture of him, you get angry and hurt. But this constant story, non-stop, isn't it? If only this, and if only that, and he should do this, and this, and this, and I'm going to tell him this, and you have all these long conversations inside your head. You're going to make him change this way, and he should, because I'm right, and he's wrong, and all this stuff. If you could write it all down, by the end of the day, you'd have a novel. Isn't it true? So where does anger come? It's clear where it exists, in the mind, in the thoughts. It's all these thoughts. It's an elaborate story about what that person did and how they shouldn't have done it and how you're right and they're wrong and if only this and I'm going to tell them that. You understand what I'm saying. Everybody knows what I'm saying. That whole big scenario, that is all thought and that is the anger. Now you know yourself, when you're feeling happy, what does it mean? You check your mind, you've got happy thoughts. He's this, he's so kind, and blah, 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 and the weather's lovely. Even if it is about the outside world, it's pleasant thoughts, isn't it? It's nice thoughts. You write them all down. You've got a very pleasant thing to read. Do you understand my point? So that's what we're dealing with. It's nothing esoteric. Dealing with anger. You think, well, how can I change anger? It's emotion, you know. We mystify emotion. Emotion is just a word we use for very strong thoughts. That's all, isn't it? That seem to have an energy of their own, seem to have a life of their own. Stop them? Don't be ridiculous. How can I stop them, we think, you know? That's how it is. That's how we feel, isn't it? We don't think we can change emotion. We don't think we can change all those thoughts. Because they do appear to have a life of their own, don't they? Like somebody inside you thinking those thoughts, driving you along, making you miserable. But it's your thoughts, you know. They're your thoughts. That person with their mean words didn't inject those thoughts into you. Isn't it? This is how we feel virtually, isn't it? So all Buddhism is saying is because of this constant thinking process, thoughts, according to the propensities, and they're all according to the propensities we have. I mean, I can attest, you know, that I had certain qualities since I was a tiny girl. I recall anger since a tiny girl. Another one of my sisters, not so much. It wasn't her propensity. It was mine, you know. Pride. Someone else not. So we can see there's a habit, and all Buddhism is saying is, and this is the longer picture of karma now, is that from the time of conception, when this consciousness came into that mother's egg and sperm, the father's, mother's and father's egg and sperm, that whole like little nucleus of you, with all that was there, with all those propensities, you know. Your mother and father didn't teach you those. They're not even possessed in their genes, not according to Buddhism. This consciousness that turned into, based on the egg and sperm of the mother, in the consciousness going into that egg and sperm turns into this package called Robina, with all those propensities. All those propensities were right there. And where they came from wasn't mother, father, wasn't God or Buddha. They're not just physical. They're not just randomly plopped there by somebody. They come from previous moments of themselves. Just like if you see today, your anger is a continuity of yesterday's anger and of the day before's, isn't it? It's something you're familiar with. It's so logical. Like the car, the green, the flower today, the growth of it, it's the continuity of the previous flower of yesterday when it was slightly smaller, going back to the seed, isn't it? Well, that's all this concept of seeds is what Buddhism uses in relation to the concept of karma. We bring all these seeds with us, which are the propensities, that then grow into the fruits, you know. So that's why, you know, we can see the energy of this anger is strong. Why? And even though we can see it is merely a bunch of thoughts, they're very potent thoughts, aren't they? They're very loaded thoughts. And they're very strong, and they feel, like I said, as if they have an energy of their own. And just to say, well, change the way you think sounds like a joke, doesn't it? It sounds like a prophetic joke. And the reason it feels like a joke is because it's so deep inside us, that's all. So habitual. So habitual. We know anything that's habitual is painful to change. So all Buddha's saying, one way of saying, what our minds are made up of is these bunches of different propensities that then, because we just assume, well, this is me, we say, well, this is just me. It feels just like me. I felt it from the time I was born. It's just me, we say. This is my personality. So we kind of concretize it. And for this reason, make it virtually impossible for us to change. Not because, as I said, in its nature it is difficult to change, but because if you have the view, this is who I am, therefore I can't change, you know, in parentheses, well, of course, you won't try. If you assume anger is who you are, and that it's impossible to change, it's an emotion. How can I change an emotion, we say? Then of course we won't try, will we? All Buddha's saying is, yes, it's an emotion. Emotion simply means a very strong propensity of thinking a certain way, such that it now is deeply your habit. And it's now become the way you view reality. And it's a philosophy you're very invested in. So of course, this is the reason. So if you start to change that view, oh, it's not the real me. Wow, it's thoughts, I can change it. It isn't my real person. It is my personality, but it's not concrete. It's just a way of thinking. If you have that view, then it starts to shake this concept of this solid, permanent, real, angry, this, that, me. In other words, you have to start seeing that it is possible. It's just a dynamic energy like anything else. Anger, jealousy, pride, you name it. Love, kindness, the same thing. You can change those too. You can lessen them, you know. Or you can increase them, up to us. This is the point. So what Buddhist practice is, what Buddhist so-called spiritual path practice is knowing your own mind, recognizing we have the power to change, recognizing that my mind is the main source of my suffering, like I've been saying, not his words. So having that as our philosophy, even though it's a baby, fragile philosophy, already some space to change. Possibility to change. Already it's possible. But you have to believe it's possible. We all can see this. If you don't believe you can ride that bike as a kid, you will never ride that bike, you know. It's very clear. It's clear that our thought the mind is the first thing. The mind is the source. If you have confidence you can do it, you will do it. Even if you're not as good at it as someone else. But if you work harder, you'll probably get better, you know, because you believe it. So this is the root of it. But we have to not just believe in an ignorant sense, but check out how it is logical. And it is logical that we can change. Because if once in our life, just once, we have refrained from saying those angry words, that is proof that anger can change. Because we just did it. We proved it. One time. If we can, just once in our life, we can recall that we reached out against our meanness and offered something to somebody, then it proves that we can change. It proves it. It's logic. And this is the point, you know. And this is one of the most necessary things, I think, is to have some kind of confidence in what we're doing, you know, which is why it's important, I think, to demystify what we mean by spiritual practice, you know. I mean, even the way we think of Buddha's practice somehow is an esoteric thing called meditation, sort of mysterious, and you change and you get feel better and mindful, these things, you know. They're just practical terms used for parts of our mind that we try to develop for very practical reasons, you know. That's all. It's important to demystify it. And of course, it's hard work. It's really tough work, you know. It's not easy at all. It's the hardest job on earth to change our mind. But the only one, if we check it, the only one that brings guaranteed results. This is true. We can see this. It's not some religious statement, you know. We can see. If we can change, if we can learn to first believe that I can be less angry, less pride, less confused, less depressed, less jealous. In theory, no matter how long it takes. If you have that belief based on the logic, you know, that the mind is not fixed. And no matter how long it takes, the process will just take care of itself, you know. If you know, when you see an acorn, this little skinny little thing, you know, you know that you've learned botany, and you know that it will become an oak tree. Now you have to know that intellectually first. It doesn't tell you, oh, there's an oak tree. You know, it doesn't just pop up from its own side. You have to be told that that's an oak tree in potential. So you know no matter how long it takes, even if it's 100 years, you know that if you just nourish it every day, logically, an oak tree will come. Same with us, same with the mind. To have this fundamental understanding of how it works. This is the very kind of central point of the whole of Buddhist practice. If you have any questions, any time, please send them, ask me. And why is it so hard for us, you know? Why is it so hard for us to stop that raging thinking process that is saying he this, he that, not fair this, poor me this, self-pity me, blah, blah, blah. Why is it so hard, you know? It's like hard. It's like going against the energy of a bomb, isn't it? It's like reversing the energy of a raging river. It feels so difficult. Well, again, like I'm saying, it's important to understand that what Buddhist way of saying is that it's not difficult in its nature. It's simple to change a thought. Just change the thought, you know. It's simple, in theory. But the reason it's so difficult is because it's for so long been going in that direction. You know, the energy, it's like that raging river going down. It's like this build-up of energy from before, raging, isn't it? That's how it is, and that's why it is so difficult. That's why it is so difficult. And this is why, in Buddhist terms, we need to think about it in this practical way, to understand the logic of it, to understand the possibility of change, that it's a logical thing. I mean, Buddhism has this concept of Buddha nature. Buddhism says, we all possess Buddha nature. Sounds kind of holy, you know, like you're all God or something. But what it means, Buddha is this term, Sanskrit, right? That just means fully awakened, fully developed, fully enlightened, these terms. And they refer to the full development of a conscious mind the full development of love, compassion, wisdom, and all the other so-called positive qualities, and the complete elimination of anger, jealousy, pride, blah, 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 and all the negative qualities. That is literally what a Buddha means, fully awakened, fully enlightened. That's what it means. It's a truly psychological statement. It's just that the implications of it are way beyond what we imagine as possible psychologically, using that term, in our culture. So, for example, Buddhism, there's no psychology, is there, that I can think of in our culture that says, that posits, that you can be absolutely free of anger. You can be absolutely free of attachment. In fact, that sounds inhuman to us. Because we don't see examples of this. We just assume, you know, if you have a little bit of anger and a little bit of attachment and a little bit of jealousy and a reasonable amount of love and a nice kind of general package of everything, then you're a reasonable human being. Well, in Buddhist terms, that's like saying, well, not have so much pollution and have just a little bit less pollution but a bit more of this, and then just accept it. It's just like completely shortchanging yourselves, you know. In Buddhist terms, and this is where the teachings in Buddhism, the Buddhist philosophy, which for a Buddhist practitioner is necessary to think about because it gives all the possibilities. You know, the Buddhist philosophy would say, Buddhist psychology, that actually the nature of our being, the nature of consciousness, the nature of awareness itself, consciousness, mind, is pure, is perfect, is clear, like water, pure, H2O. And that pollution is very real, but it's not in the nature of that water. And no matter how long that pollution has been there, we know, if you find the right methods, you can completely rid that water of the pollution and thus kind of uncover the pure H2O-ness of that water. Just like that, Buddhism says about our minds. Just that. That's the philosophy. That's the view in Buddhism. And of course, in Buddhist terms too, the whole kind of deal is a logical, is meant to be a logical thing. Not just like a belief, a religious thing. I believe it, you know. There's no concept like that in Buddhism, just believing in something because somebody said. That's ignorance in Buddhist terms. Which is why, as a Buddhist, it demands of us that we listen to the teachings and think about this stuff as philosophy and really see to try to find the truth, you know. What Buddhism is in pursuit of is truth, how reality is. Seeing reality as it is. That's what Buddhism is talking about, you know. And all Buddha's saying is the extent to which we don't see reality, which is the extent to which we see things through anger, jealousy, pride, and all the rest, is the extent to which we suffer. So, honey, don't want to suffer? Give up the rubbish. Depollute your mind, you know, because it's your nature anyway. This is the Buddhist view. So it seems to me the way our minds work in the West, you know, we have these very intelligent minds.
Use them.
Really use them to see how it is true that, yes, I can change. If we can get some conviction in that, then nothing will stop us, you know. Just this victim mentality that we all have now, we kind of sink into the inertia of, oh, I can't do it, it's no good, it's all their fault. We dump it on the outside world, you know. It's completely taking away responsibility, taking away the power and taking away the responsibility from ourselves, popping, dumping it on everybody else. Everything else. And we, all our politics, all our raging, all our rubbishing, all our wars are all based on that philosophy, aren't they? You check, you know. Full of rage when you read something that's wrong out there, you know. We can apply all that energy to our own mind, we'd all become Buddhas in 2 minutes flat. Honestly. Unbelievable how we could be. If we applied all the energy we apply now to the outside world, to the changing of our own mind. Unbelievable results in Buddhist terms. Lama Yeshe uses the term, he says, he refers to ego as self-pity me. I like this sort of little cliche, little phrase, the self-pity me, I, you know. It's kind of interesting, because you check ego. What we call ego now, it sounds like big and strong, you know. But actually the Buddhist view of ego is actually, it's pathetic. It's a self-pity me. It's a very accurate term. Because you check the feeling of I behind anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, depression, you check. It's this poor, little, badly done by hurt. I'm not being unkind to us now. It's how it feels, isn't it? That's the feeling, isn't it? It's poor me, little me, baby me, big, horrible, ugly outside them, you know? Isn't it? It's kind of interesting. That's the irony of ego. It actually is this little kind of unhappy self-pity. Ego doesn't like us at all. Ego is miserable. Ego is addicted to the neuroses. Ego is addicted to anger and jealousy and finding the bad things. You check a person you know who is always angry. Forget about yourself now. They're always pointing to the grey clouds, aren't they? The sun's right next to it. They all, what do they check out? They always find the problem. That's the nature of anger. It's the nature, you know, it's the nature of all the delusions. They always find the problem. And then it becomes a huge mountain. This is the feeling of I. It's a self-pity, and it doesn't like. And it's kind of panic-stricken. You check, you know. The feeling of I is really panic-stricken all the time. Behind anger, you know, it's almost like it's unbearable to get this horrible word from this port. It's like you can't even bear. It's like freak out, isn't it? You have to stop it. Attachment's the same. This delicious divine thing out there and this little hungry me here. Unbearable to not get it. Panic. It's like you're going to die if you don't get the object, the person, the thing, the word. That's the nature of attachment. The nature of all these deluded states of mind, which come from this, in Buddhist terms, this fundamental delusion called this self-existent me, the self-pity me, you know, at the center of our universe. And this is, like I said, samsaric philosophy. This is what Buddhism is saying, cutting across all the, you know, the philosophies we have in the world and the cultures and all. This is the one we all aspire to. Animals, ants, dogs, humans, you name it. If we suffer, then by definition, we are caught up in this samsaric philosophy. Based on the self-existent me, therefore there's a me that needs something, and that's called attachment. And therefore there's a me when it doesn't get what it wants, gets angry. That's called, you know, that's freaking out. And then the jealousy, all of these are based on this I. It's the way of describing the samsaric being. You know. And then the philosophy of the samsaric person is, like we said, the outside world's the cause of suffering, the outside world's the cause of happiness, other people do it to me. So therefore change them. We can see, look at our culture, even the best parts of our culture, as opposed to, say, Tibetan culture. Even 50 years ago before the Chinese came in, before the communists came in, virtually medieval, you know. You think you'd wake up in the Middle Ages if you popped up in Tibet. So externally, it's very clear. If you look at our external world, so even the good parts, it's evident the difference in our philosophies, isn't it? Theirs is obviously much more internal, to the detriment of the outside. So they're all off in the mountains becoming Buddhas, you know. And there's us, what are we doing? Making this external world more and more magnificent every day. But look at the neuroses, look at the suffering, look at the mental breakdowns and the murders and the violence. That seem to come hand in hand. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? It's kind of interesting. And all our world says is that we obviously put more power into the outside world because, look, we keep trying to make it better. Or we keep trying to destroy it, one or the other. So it's obvious where our philosophy is. So Buddha's not saying chuck out the outside world and go back to being medieval. How ridiculous, no. It's simply saying, Buddhism simply saying, you know, we've missed the boat. We've missed out on the thing that is the creator of this universe, which is the individual minds of individual sentient beings. Because each of us, moment by moment, is creating this person. If you spend all your life being angry, don't be surprised when you end up at 60 years old, angry and gnarled and mean and face showing it. You can just look at other people. You can tell. You don't have to be clairvoyant to see how they feel, you know. If you see a person who spent their life being kind, you see a blissful human being. You can't help but be moved by them, you know. It's obvious. So in this simple way, we can see how we create ourselves from moment to moment. God is not up there doing it to us, you know. We're doing it ourselves. It's very clear at this level. It's so clear. Yes, the person who is angry, who looking like that, believes that everybody in their world, they'll, you know, have a catalogue of all the people who've been mean to them. And it might even be true that people have been mean to them. But the Buddhist view is that the cause even of that is the anger. Now, and the anger from the past. It's another whole, the past one, another whole story. You know, the view of anger. The view of karma. But the real one I'm trying to get to is this very here and now tasty one. Of beginning to see that it is possible to get what we want, which is to be happy and to not suffer. So simple. So simple, but so profound, you know. And that the key to it is changing our own mind. And the key to that is recognizing that I have the power to change the way I think and feel. And that they are the determining factors in whether I'm happy, not the outside world. And it is so evident. You know, you have the richest people on this earth with the most beautiful body and the beautiful objects, and they are totally suffering. We all know this. You can have some of the most poor, sick, suffering human beings externally, and they can be the most happy. We know these things. They're almost cliches. They're so true. Well, that's the simple point that Buddhism is pointing to. That's all. It's proof. It's proof. The outside world doesn't cause happiness, and the outside world doesn't cause suffering. Not mainly. Of course, it's a very important condition. There's no question. But it's not the main thing. Just like, and this view is a very kind of analogy in Buddhism. Just like the seed, you know. It's obvious the apple seed is the main cause of the apple tree. But we act now as if when we pour water on that soil, we made the tree. That's how we think now, Buddhism's saying. And we know that's ignorant when it comes to botany. We know perfectly well you can put water on that soil for 32 years, you will never get an apple tree unless there's an apple seed there. Well, exactly the same. You know, he can abuse me for 32 years, but if I don't have anger in my mind, as Lama Zopa says, I will not see an enemy. And I will not be angry. I will not suffer. I will just increase my compassion for him. That's all. It's clear. It's reasonable. It's logic. And like I said, if we can just once or twice in a day apply this, bring the energy back to myself every time something happens. It's so difficult, you know. It's so difficult, too, because it's caught up in all the kind of the view of morality. Because let's say he is, you know, I have a close relationship with this person. Let's say he's my child or something, let's say. So that's, this whole one of my anger is one thing, it's very clear. But of course I have a responsibility to this person. So this is where it makes it so difficult to distinguish, you know. Because you've got this other aspect of my responsibility and to try to help them become a better person. All of this is my part of my job. Or even in a relationship, equal relationship with a person, not a parent-child one. You know. There's still these other issues involved, helping the other person. But it's so hard for us to discriminate between these lots, you know. It's so very hard for us to look into just my part and to differentiate it from where his part is, you know. It's very hard. So Buddhism uses the analogy that a bird needs two wings. And so in terms of, eventually when you're a Buddha, an enlightened being, a fully developed person, you have these two wings fully developed. And one wing, and that's what we're talking about here, to some extent, is all the one of the inner work, the work of the wisdom side, wisdom they call it, developing all my own qualities, lessening my own neuroses, seeing more clearly what's going on, you know, wisdom. That's for my benefit. Then there's the other wing, the one of so-called compassion, which is all the work in relation to other. So that's where it becomes very difficult for us, to be clear. But in a way, if we're trying to see which job we're doing, which one we're emphasizing at this moment. So in terms of looking at Rubina's suffering, she's doing this job. In terms of trying to really help him, I'm doing this job. So if I'm doing this job, he is my business. If I'm doing this job, he is not my business. My own mind is my business. What he does is not my business. And right now we can see mostly our heads are in his business, analysing what he did wrong and how he shouldn't have done it. And it is wrong to do this. And all the way we see in our culture, the unbelievable level of blame. It's become like a highly sophisticated philosophy now, to the point where, and even, you know, I mean, even people who get the death sentence, we're talking about victims' rights, you know, which is appropriate. But you can always see it's become a part of the culture. That if a person who is a victim is very angry and wants that person to get the death penalty, that has a say in whether that person gets the death penalty. But if a person is patient and kind and they're asked, do they forgive the person, and they say yes, that person won't get so much, you know, won't get such a penalty. So it's become even part of our culture now because it's seen as so right. This one of outside causing my suffering. It's very interesting. It's just my way of saying it, you know. So I think it's quite shocking, actually. We can see our whole philosophy, the way our culture is now, is based on this philosophy of the outsider is to blame and the moral issue, which is technically correct. Of course, there's the morality. Buddhism is based on morality, you know, that a person should not harm another. It's very clear. But of course, we always use this to point to the fingers. We never think, well, me. We always think he. Because morality says he shouldn't cause suffering, so then we think it is our right to dump on him and to demand that he change and to sue him and to put him into jail and hang him and all the rest. And then I'll be happy, we think. I mean, the number of people you read in the papers who, when the person's finally got the death penalty, now they can be relieved, they say. Now they can be happy. They've been waiting all these years for it, you know. It just shows. It just shows how deep it is in our mind, how we actually think it is right. So yes, there's no question, nobody should hurt anybody. But the whole point of this wing of practice is, given that he does hurt me, now what to do about it? How to make me happy? Putting him in jail will not make me happy. We think it will. Changing my own mind will make me happy. Sure, meanwhile, call the cops. Put him in jail too, because maybe that's the way culture goes, and that's how you have to run a society. But not out of anger, not out of bitterness, not out of resentment, because somehow that's just the way things are. That's okay. Meanwhile, still change your mind. Forgive the person. Because why? The first reason we're using here is because not forgiving will break your heart. I remember reading one of this woman who's part of a group of people, parents of people whose children have been killed on, you know, murdered. I think the people, this group, I forget, something about people on death row. The murderers are on death row, okay? And this woman said that when she finally decided she was going to write a letter of forgiveness, basically, to the person who murdered her child, the change in herself, the relief, was unbelievable. I can't remember her words at all, but that was the idea, you know. When she finally was able to let go of the rage and the blaming and the bitterness and the resentment, she, like a miracle, changed. The burdens were lifted from her heart, you know. That's the simple point here. The bottom line of this is, honey, if you want to be happy, you give up your anger. And of course, in the Buddhist view about karma, from the longer term perspective, that every single thing we say, think and do is producing ourselves from moment to moment, and then when the mind leaves the body, continuing to experience the results from moment to moment. That this is the inexorable law in Buddhist terms. This is the law that governs reality. Not God up there pulling strings, and not some random set of events. They're neither of those in Buddhist terms. Is that each one of us, every living being, every scorpion, every human, every dog, every evil being, every good being, is each moment experiencing the fruits of their past actions, and is each moment sowing the seeds for their future experiences. This is the Buddhist view of reality, from the broader perspective. So given that, then you know that if that person killed your child, that they're getting the death penalty or not is kind of irrelevant. Because they're going to be, according to what's in their mind, they will experience the fruits of their actions. Because this is the law of reality, according to Buddhism, the law of karma. So there's much less bitterness, because you know the person's going to suffer anyway. You don't want them to suffer, but that's just inevitable. And if you have genuine compassion, if you try to develop compassion, then all the more, due to karma, all the more compassion you will have, because you'll realize that person who harmed you, let's say, or somebody else, is going to suffer terribly. And why you're suffering now is because of what you've done in the past too. So we're all in the same boat. This is the bigger picture of karma, which actually causes us to have a lot more forgiveness, a lot more compassion. Because we're all in the same boat. There's not one of us who isn't.
I have a question.
Yes.
When you say the real meaning of compassion, what do you mean with that? Because according with what I know a little bit about compassion,
yeah. I understand.
Sorry,
you think a bit patronizing.
I
yes, no, I understand. The Buddhist understanding of this term, okay, they would say that, for example, the real meaning of the term love is it's very altruistic, you know, the pure love, that I want you to be happy, and I'm delighting when you are happy. And then what Buddhism would say compassion is not only do I want you to be happy, but I find your suffering unbearable. And so it's a real reaching out to another person. It's not any kind of the patronizing pity. This is completely inappropriate, the way Buddhism uses this term. So compassion is something very wholesome. And actually, what's interesting, the view of compassion is really, in Buddhist terms, based on the understanding that why you are suffering in the long term is because of your own delusions, because of your own past actions. This is in the long term, you know. Whereas if we look mostly now, when I think of myself when I was politically active, very politically active before I was Buddhist, I had great compassion for the poor people, but I hated the rich people. You understand? So my compassion was balanced with this, and it wasn't pure compassion in that way. You had to blame somebody. So as long as the person was a victim, I was prepared to feel sorry for them, yes, but I didn't like the other person. Then when I was a feminist, I hated the men and I loved women, you know. So that's the way we tend to think of compassion now. It's mixed with a lot of anger, a lot of blaming, you know. So we're prepared to be sorry for poor, innocent people. But to have compassion for a person who is the one who did the murdering, this seems very strange, you know. But Buddhism would say every reason to have compassion for every living being. Because one, you do the negative action because of the propensities in your mind that drive you to do it because of your past. And two, unless you change your own mind now and take responsibility for that harm you did, you will suffer terribly. Because that's the nature of karma, you know. It's not punishment from God or anything. So this is the basis of genuine compassion. It's like a parent who's got two kids, you know, and one day she beats up him, you know, the girl beats up the boy, so you get mad at the girl and you love the little boy, you know, and then tomorrow he beats up her, and tomorrow the opposite picture. Do you understand? It's a bigger picture of compassion, not just this pity one, you know. That makes sense what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, again, of course, not easy to get this one, but in the Buddhist view, this genuine picture of compassion is based on the understanding of cause and effect. Of karma, and we're all experiencing the fruits of our past, and we'll all continue, and are all creating the causes for our future. So it's based on some kind of intelligence, you know, not just some kind of pity. Well, because this is short-lived. Pity changes, you know. I mean, I could see when I was particularly active, one minute I loved these people, the next minute I hated them. You know, when I was a feminist, I hated all the poor men. I loved all the poor men before, but now because they're men, I hate them. So I changed, you know, my picture. Well, we can see with our pity about animals. We love cats because we're attached to cats. We mightn't like rats, you know, so we kill the rats. In Buddhist terms, every living being has the right to live. Cats, dogs, cat, doesn't matter. Rats, doesn't matter. You know. All consciousness, taking forms, suffering, not suffering, like this. Bigger picture. But just in a practical day-to-day way, compassion is this when you know yourself, when you have this a person you're close to and they suffer, your heart finds it unbearable. And I've even heard many people say, I wish it was me. That's real. That's like a profound level of compassion, when you actually would even wish to take it on yourself so that person can be free of it. This is extraordinary, you know, quite extraordinary. Any more questions, perhaps?
Any hints on how to make that leap from recognizing your mind?
I think the first huge step is to see it. And then already with that comes, okay, would come a determination, you know. It's sort of like if you're playing the piano and you didn't realize you're making a mistake. All this time you've been playing it wrong, and suddenly someone points out that your elbow's in the wrong position. That's why you can't do it. So then first the recognition, wow, and now the determination to fix it and to catch it every time it comes. So it's automatic. The seeing of it, sometimes we think that's just kind of, well, I see it, then what? But actually the seeing of it has to be then coming with the determination to want it to change. And that'll just take time. It's an evolutionary thing, you know. And it's not going to happen immediately. No way. Just because we see our anger now doesn't mean it's going to change. We have to want it to change. And that very wanting itself is already practice. Because the wanting of anything is the first step in doing it. My wanting to walk out the door is why I walk out the door. So my wanting to change my anger, based on seeing it, is already part of the process of changing the anger. It doesn't happen immediately. It's an evolutionary, slow process. You know? So catching it again, adjusting it again. And eventually it gets to the point when because you're wanting to change it is based on the knowledge that it causes you suffering, and you don't want the suffering. That's behind it too, you see. And then it's just this painful, kind of humbling experience of falling into the same traps every time. I mean, we're ancient creatures of habit, aren't we? And this is why I think so often we give up, because it just seems like it's not possible to change, doesn't it? It really feels like it's an uphill battle. How can I change anger? I can see my mind, you know. And I think the thing is to not have fantasy expectations about how long it takes. That's, I think, is something I can see for sure. It's just yes to have the confidence that every time you go against it, even a tiny bit, every time you struggle with it even, even if you don't feel you succeeded with all the chatter. Already you're affecting it, already. Whereas if you allow it just to go full blown, nothing will ever change then. But even this tiny baby little voice arguing with the big mountain of anger, it's enough already to chip away at it. And every day this little voice will get bigger, bigger, bigger. Isn't it? Don't you find? But I think it's a really humbling thing. It's just not magic overnight. It's just, I mean, I just can see this, you know. And certain people, you know, in your life will pop up that have an overwhelming effect on you. You thought you'd kind of got a handle on your anger for a while, and suddenly you just feel like a baby again. Because that's how strong karma is with some people. Very strong karma with some people, you know. So just more test. Okay. Next round. It's very humbling, I think, because it really, I think most of the time we feel like it's overwhelming. How can I do it? I see my own mind every day, you know. I mean, so-called trying to practice for how many years? It just seems overwhelming sometimes. A little bit every day. Little bit. The aspirations. Really and truly. Much of the prayers we do in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, is like aspirational. May this, may that, may sentient beings be happy, may I this. They're just aspirational. They're like, what do we call them in the West? Affirmations. That's the purpose of them. Putting into your mind those thoughts that slowly they will become bigger, you know. And I think even though it mightn't look like we're doing much, making much progress, I think by doing this type of work every day, combined, say, with other practices, it's sort of pulling out weeds at a very deep level that we can't even see the evidence of right now. Do you see what I mean? That's my feeling. That makes sense? Just to have, I think, to give up, to not give up. They say, and I think it's really true, you know, in Buddhist terms, they would say that one of the main qualities that a bodhisattva needs is one they talk about the perfections of a bodhisattva is perseverance, enthusiastic perseverance. But I think anyone, you check, anybody on this earth, you're the best, you know, the best athlete, the best pianist, the best, some of my friends in prison, the best gangsters, the ones with most enthusiasm. Enthusiasm actually is saying, I can do it. And that's a really incredibly important quality. We can see, if you don't have that, you can't do anything, you know. So we have to develop that one. And that just means, and that's why in Buddhist terms, enthusiasm, I can do it, comes from seeing how logically it is true. That if you have changed your anger once in your life, that proves it is not fixed. And that's the logic behind, you know, this enthusiasm. It's not just some kind of blind enthusiasm, you know. It's a logical one in a way. So not giving up is the main one. This is what I got from one of my friends in prison, actually. This is this very ordinary guy who's in prison for life, for killing somebody in a car accident. You know, he was an alcoholic. And he's really practicing so hard. And he said how he has to practice in prison. You know, totally insane environment, completely berserk, unbelievable noise like you can't imagine. And he said he had one particular experience in meditation that was very good one time. And he got you can see he just doggedly does it every day, regardless of the crazy environment, regardless of the obstacles. And he said, Rabina, what I learned from this was never give up. You know? I think that's the one I really can see. We have to have this one. Because if we have this one, no matter how bad life gets, no matter how bad our mind seems, we keep going, keep going, keep going. Because you know, it's just like the acorn example. You know that even if you water it, when you're watering it every day, you might see evidence for a long time of any oak tree coming. But if you've understood the logic of botany, you will keep putting that water on. But we, because we're so kind of, it's ironic, attachment is so strong that we want to see the results now. And because we don't, we give up. Isn't it? I think so. This is why it's important to think about this stuff in a logical way. Then gives us some kind of basis to want to keep doing it. Not just out of blind religious faith, but out of some, you know, practical. So what else, people? Anything else? Oh. Any other questions? Does it make sense what I'm talking about? Yes, please. Yes.
I know for myself there is a way that I go about doing it where I say, sure. I want to make changes and I need to do it pretty soon.
Yes. I understand.
But if it happens, there's pride.
That's right. I know, that can be a real trick, kind of. I know that. I think it's just really learning, to, if you like, it's a way of saying it, to recognize within us that, yes, we have this label, I, but forget about that now. Just then recognize, what is the I made up of? It's made up of the good bits of you and the bad bits of you, simply speaking. The good bits of you are called love, patience, generosity, kindness. Yeah? The so-called bad bits of you are called attachment, anger, jealousy, depression. Bad in the sense they make you miserable, and the others good in the sense that they make you happy and then benefit others. So in this more loose sense, just being aware. So if you, another way of saying it, we can see there's a good side and bad side to all these qualities. So to rejoice in your effort is a very wholesome thing. It's like a humble recognition of your effort and great, I can do it. Then the bad side of that is called pride, when it's the concretizing and the building up of something, this I is special. So we just have to be very skillful to catch, you know. And don't chuck the baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, well, I can't rejoice at all because it might become pride. Just keep trying to rejoice and then catch it when it comes. Because the characteristic of when it's ego is when it's concretized and sort of puffed up, you know. When it's rejoicing, it's sort of much softer. So, for example, self-confidence and pride. You know, when a person's got pride, it means I'm better than you. And I'm checking on the outside all the time, and I've got this puffed-up sense of an I. But actually, if I look at pride, which is coming from the wrong eye, it's very nervous. It's freaking out. It's like a little kid in there. And as soon as I find someone who's better than me, I'll become completely pathetic and I'll cry and get all deflated. That's the pride. But self-confidence doesn't compare with you. Self-confidence is content with my effort and then rejoices if you're better than me. And I increase my self-confidence from that. So it's just a different flavor. When it's a negative one, it's a different flavor. We just have to learn, it's like a feeling, to recognize the flavor. When there's, you know, when it's bound to be. You try to practice and become a good person, or become generous, and I start telling you, aren't I so generous? Come on, shut up, Rabina. Yes, it's good you're generous. Give it a break, baby, you know. There are other people more generous than you. So the lamas would say, when you really feel, when it's pride, meaning all the puffed up one, tell yourself some things that you can't do. And then when it's low self-esteem, which is like the deflated pride, tell yourself some things you can do. You build yourself up. It's just, and more than anything, it's learning to recognize the flavor behind these different feelings, because they're very hard to see. The difference between attachment and love is almost impossible to see sometimes. I can feel so good about you and want to and help you so much, and I really be convinced it's because I want you to be happy. But the proof of that is if you start going against what I want, then I'll get as mad as hell, you know. So it's really hard when it's all happening to see the difference between attachment and love. But we just have to learn to be skillful. That's all. Just constantly checking. Not getting too neurotic about it, you know, but just having the skill. It's like trying to distinguish between milk and water when they're mixed together. Initially, virtually impossible. When you're really skillful, you'll be able to. So just slowly, slowly, you know. Yes, I tell you, it really is, you know. It really, really, it's like anything. If you're trying to play the piano, you're constantly aware. And the more skillful you get, the more subtle you get in your discrimination between what was wrong and what was not wrong. It's just like anything. But of course, because we're being mindful of our mind, it's more kind of personal than being mindful of your fingers, you know. It just seems to be more because it's just all internal, it's so hard to get clear. But it is possible. So just keep trucking. And then learn from your mistakes. Like anything, like you would with the piano, learn from your mistakes. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. That's okay, you know. Don't be afraid. Another little characteristic, I think, another way of describing my feeling, is that when it's a so-called virtuous or positive state of mind, or a so-called, you know, neurotic one, coming from I, is if, for example, it's attachment, it's a very fierce sense of you out there and me here, and I've got to get you. Whereas it's love, it's a sense of we. It's very comfortable. And you're, it's kind of like an expanded I that includes you. So when it's pride, it's sort of like an isolated sense of me against everybody else. When it's self-confidence, it's like a comfortable, relaxed, I'm rejoicing in me, but I'm not threatened by other people. It's more of a bigger sense of me connected to others, a softer feeling of relationship to other involved when it's not the self-centered I. When it's a self-centered I, it's like isolated, lonely, or special, either way. You see what I mean? We can feel those for sure. And again, this hard one I was saying before, you know, if I'm trying to do the wisdom work, and I've got this relationship with this person, and I'm trying to do the wisdom side, I've got to fiercely learn to look at if it's all coming from anger and neurosis, or whether it really is coming to try and help him. I don't want to tell him about what he did, you know. Most of the time we can see it's the anger ourselves, our own anger, our own resentment. But we pretend it's for his benefit, we're going to do something. So the first job is to really work on this one. And then when the emotion has gone from it, if it is appropriate, and that he is, and you know that the person is open to it, and your motive is very pure, then indeed, say something for his benefit. But much of the time now, we say something or point on the outside. It's nothing to do with their, for their benefit. It's completely to do with our own anger or our own benefit. So it's a really hard one, this one, especially in a relationship, to know when it is appropriate. In other words, the reason to say something to somebody else about their faults, the reason is because it's genuinely for their benefit. But the practical issue is, the person has to be open to it. They have to be open to it, you know. And you have to know that it's the right time to say something, and you have to do it from the purest motivation, genuinely for their benefit. So we check this, then 99% of the time we point out people's faults. We simply wouldn't do it, because we can see it's not really for their benefit at all. It's for our own benefit. It's our own vindictiveness, you know. So nothing wrong with trying to help another person by pointing out their faults. But you almost got to be such a high person yourself, so totally humble and so clear and genuinely compassionate. It's very rare, you know. It's very rare. Well, actually, as Lama Yeshe said one time about learning to understand our own attachment. Just one example of one of these deluded states of mind, you know. He said, I can tell you about it for a whole year. But unless you begin through meditation, through looking at your own mind, to build something up, then you'll never understand it. And that's the point, I think, about all this stuff. Although these words are all very easy words, they're not esoteric. Love is not an esoteric word. Anger is not. Jealousy is not. Pride is not. We all know these words. But to recognize in the soup of our emotion each of these different components is a very difficult job. And that's where the inner work through meditation, in Buddhist terms, is simply the tool that you use to see yourself. It's easy to talk about them out there, and very easy to point it out to some other person. So hard to taste it, to experience it in your own being. And this just takes time. This just takes time, that's all. Just time. Just be patient. It is possible. Definite. And the more you do it, naturally, if you, just like the more you play the piano, if you obey all the right rules of the, you know, piano playing, it is logic that you will get better. Same with looking at your mind. If you, according to the system you're using, let's say the Buddhist one, and you apply the appropriate rules, you know, there are rules of doing things, there are ways to do things that are skillful, that have come from other people's experience, that have worked, then it is logical if you do all the right thing. It will bring the results. That's why we should persevere. It's logic, you know. Just like that oak tree. Any more questions? Yes. Yes. That's right. No, not at all. No. I really see the point you're making, and I think when we have gone through our thing, then that's the time maybe to move. Because it's almost, if you're looking from the wisdom point of view, which is how you're talking, your work, you know, then this external world called your job, your relationship, is the ground in which you do all that work. And when you've done all your work, and you get this distancing from it, and you say, okay, well maybe that all you're saying is, well, I've done the job, bye-bye, move on from this one. And this could be the same in a relationship. And it's not necessarily negative. The reason we mostly leave jobs and relationships now is because we get angry and we get bored. And our attachment gets bored, so we want to have something else to excite us. So if your reason is because you're really working on yourself and you've now finished that work, keep moving, honey, as quick as you like. If that's, you know, but it's got to be clear. But if it's just another way of avoiding something, you know, I don't like him, I'll change, get a more handsome one. This job's boring because all these people are creeps, I'm going to get another nice one. Well, then it gets all exciting, oh, that looks so great, then you get more with that, and then we go on again. We all know. The test. I think, yes, when you are involved with the work you're doing inside your own mind. So basically the question is this. If what you're doing in your life, the outside world, is actually, there's two purposes, in Buddhist terms, there's two reasons to do anything. That's to develop this wing or to develop this wing. So if whatever you're doing is actually helping you practice patience and humility and lessening your attachment and lessening your anger, then it's a fantastic thing to do. Or if whatever you're doing is increasing your love and your ability to help others, then it's a fantastic thing to do. If you can really assess that, then the answer will be clear. And don't try to make it perfect. I mean, it doesn't matter, you know. It's all right. Learn. I mean, so you leave and you get another job and you'll learn from it. Learn from your mistakes. Don't be afraid, is it, not to make it perfect. Do you understand? Do you see what I'm saying? It's okay, you know. But in general, if you have this feeling, time is finished, you know. The karma has run out. The gas tank has run out. You've done your job there. Time to move on. I mean, don't try to make it perfect. Don't try to think, well, I'm not sure I might do it for the wrong reason. That's okay. Learn. Are we communicating? Yes.
And I came back and
everything changed. Oh, that's interesting. The Dalai Lama was in Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah, it's the circumstances.
Okay. Changed. Okay. Then maybe that's saying something. Sure. Yeah. Good. Be brave. Be brave. So have the aspiration. This is the main thing. Have this motivation. Okay. It's sort of like you're walking on a road. I always use this example. For me, it's very good. It's like you're walking on a road. And you haven't got a clue where the turnoff is. But you know. So you don't panic. You don't take the wrong turnoff. You don't stand still. You can't go back. You just keep moving. And you have the aspiration. May I do what is most beneficial. May I make the right turnoff. So when you're going along with that motivation, when the time is right and all the conditions come together, oh, there it is. It's very clear. So have that aspiration. It will definitely become clear. Yeah, that's it. Meanwhile, work on patience. But have the aspiration. That's the cause. They often have this little phrase in Buddhism that everything exists on the tip of the wish. Meaning, the thought, may I do. Every day, you know, may I, this in relationship, you want to kill him, and one day don't be surprised when you have your knife in your hand, you kill him. It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from past imprints in the mind, you know. Might have just been the last week, could have been the last life, but the imprints were there. So, the imprints to may I do what is most beneficial will eventually logically ripen in that decision. You might see the turn off now, but when it comes, when you get to it, all the conditions will have come together and it'll be so clear. Almost the choice will make itself. You won't need to make it. So have that aspiration. That's your real cause. That's sowing the seed to make the right choice, you know. As painful as it might be or might not be. Because if you had this view, I want to do what is most beneficial, you couldn't get anything higher than that. You can't get anything more encompassing. I don't mean higher in a moral sense. It's the most encompassing motivation possible. So just keep having that one, then it'll be perfect. Well, I know it's time to finish, but it feels like time to finish. Anybody else got questions? No? Go on, darling. Yeah.
In relation, well, compassion for someone who is whose bad karma is ripening.
What do you mean?
Actually, Michael Roach made this analogy that, you know, karma is like a seed. You can't push a tree back
yes.
into the ground.
Yes.
So a bad karma tree. A friend is
suffering. You mean
suffering?
Yes.
From that's ripening.
Yeah.
How do you help in a compassionate way without
trying.
To,
yes.
So, you know,
yes. I understand.
The karmic
law. Well, I think no. I think. Listen, it's like this. If I'm dying of cancer, as a result of my karma, then there's nothing wrong with if you can show me any kind of love to help me experience that in a better way. How incredible! How kind of you. In one way, if karma can be averted and karma can be made more quick, karma can be lessened. You can lessen the ripening of karma by doing certain practices. So a person can. So even though what he's saying is exactly right, it doesn't contradict that you can make that tree grow more quickly, or you can make it die more quickly by purifying, doing certain practices. That karmic tree can go boom, boom, and then finish much more quickly. That's very possible, for sure. That's another thing. So anything you can do to help me bear it, for example. Or anything you can do, if you're a Buddhist and you have certain lamas do certain prayers for me, that can purify, help me purify my karma much more quickly. So there's no way that, what I think he's really saying is there's no way you can make it go back. You can't do that. But you can also certainly help me bear it more. And you can certainly do many things to even alleviate it. For sure you can. Sometimes you can't if the karma is so strong. You can see with two people that say, you know, let's say us in our relationship, we're mean-mouthing, bad-mouthing and fighting, and you're our friend. And you want to help us. You can see it's evident we're completely destroying each other. But if our karma between each other is so strong, our delusions are so heavy, you can come in every day and give us lectures and want to help us. We'll just tell you to bugger off and we're going to keep fighting. You see my point? So it's a question of having the skill. So if you can, some people have got the karma so strongly to suffer from that cancer or from that illness that nothing will change it. But some people, just by doing a meditation, can heal themselves. So you have to have the skill to know what to do when. But to simply,
how do you develop that?
Well, that's the wisdom side. That's the wisdom side. Working on your own mind. Understanding your own mind. Recognizing your own delusions. Doing your purification practice. I mean, that's where the skill comes from. Because wisdom is not used in a light way in relation to this wing. What wisdom means, finally, is the wisdom. You develop the wisdom that sees reality as it is. So all Buddhism is saying is that it's the presence of the delusions in the mind now that cloud that wisdom. So why we can't see clearly what is right for him is because of the presence of my own attachment, my own ignorance, my own jealousy, my own grasping, my own neuroses. So by working on those, you're necessarily becoming more clear about other people. Necessarily. And you can only have whatever wisdom you've got. And again, aspiration. To want to do what is most beneficial. So maybe even some, you'll just do what's beneficial even without much, what seems to be much wisdom, because you have the wish to do what's beneficial. Do you see what I'm saying? And of course it depends on what kind of, as you're saying, negative karma ripening. If it's in terms of a sickness, that's fairly evident what you can and can't do. In terms of just suffering, it's hard, mental or difficulties in their lives, it's sometimes very hard. Sometimes very little, except simply being a friend. Even that, I mean, sometimes I think that's very, it's like a big relief in a way when we have a close relationship with a certain person. It's like my mother, everything I did, she just felt so responsible for. Her heart broke every time I suffered, and she blamed herself every time something went wrong. It was like, it's an over-exaggerated sense of responsibility, especially in close relationships. And that just clouds everything. It's not helpful, you know. So the thing is, sometimes it's heartbreaking to watch a person have to go through what they've got to go through. But sometimes that's all you can do, but just be there. And I know in my own life, the suffering I've just had to do, but I've remembered the people who are my friends who supported me through it, just by being there, and you knew they were there. They mightn't do anything, but you knew they were there. And you knew that they were there, meaning their heart was with you. That's very precious, you know. Because in the end, we just have to do it ourselves sometimes, isn't it? That's the one, you know, we have this wish to benefit others, we have this compassion wing. We do have the wish to benefit, but when there's attachment involved, it gets very clouded. We end up doing neurotic things, you know, not helpful at all. Kind of just, we end up interfering. It's not appropriate. So if we continually have, on the one side, the wish to benefit, which is incredible, never give that up, and then developing all the time the wisdom from working on our own mind, then boom, we'll end up having what you call intuitively knowing what is right to do. But it's not just some freak thing, you know. It'll come from clarity, because your own investment is less involved. So maybe just finish with this aspiration, his wish to develop our own wisdom, to develop the wisdom that sees, that acts, the simple wisdom, the simple level of wisdom, already difficult level, that can see that through awareness of my own mind, which we can develop through meditation, you know, just slowly practicing, controlling the mind, keeping it focused. That's a skill that we develop to then, in our daily life, to notice what's arising and to begin to avert, to begin to have some kind of handle on this kind of uncontrolled emotions that we have now. Mainly, uncontrolled, mainly because we've never tried, and secondly because we don't think it's possible. And thirdly because we believe the outside person is the thing we should be changing anyway, not me. Isn't it? So may we develop this skill for our benefit, definitely, and the benefit of others. I'm going to sing a prayer that actually expresses this. It's all the virtue we've created, the merit we've created, the positive energy in our minds we have created by listening to these teachings, thinking about them, contemplating them. Gewadinyu dudag lama sangge drugyurne dro chi kyang ma lu pa te yi sa la ke pa sho chang chub sem cho grin po che ma ke pa nam ke gu chi Ke pa nyam pa me pa yang gong ne gong du pa wa shu. Okay. Thanks, everybody.